Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
This is the Ethics Experts. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber, hello, bestie. Hope you're having an amazing day. You see what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts? You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. So hit that subscribe button. You requested him. He is here, the man, Adam Turteltaub. How are you, Adam?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Good, man. Really excited to get you on the Ethics Experts. You're somebody that I've known and followed on LinkedIn and through the SCCE and the HCCA for a while. So really excited to get you on and talk Dodgers, all things Dodgers.
Great. Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, I do the podcast series and I'm usually the one asking the questions. So I appreciate the opportunity to be the one giving the answers.
Yeah, the student becomes the teacher. So buckle up, everybody. So you are the Chief Engagement and Strategy Officer for the Healthcare Compliance Association and for the Society for Corporate Compliance and Ethics.
Correct.
So how did you get in? Let's start there. How did you wind up in this really interesting position, this focused on engagement, focused on strategy for, you know, kind of the bellwether of our industry?
Well, you know, I think it's probably good to go back to how I got into compliance, which is honestly totally by accident. I was working for a company, this is back in, 2000, that was a jobs database for lawyers. And I knew Dov Seidman, who ran LRN and founded it a little bit, reached out to him, to see if there's any connection. He ended up hiring me. I spent a lot of time at LRN, then joined SCC and HCCA in 2008. And from the start, my job really was sort of a catch-all, a lot of different things, working closely with Roy Snell when he was the CEO and now Jerry Zak. Roy used to say the best title for me is, he said, vice president in charge of these kinds of things.
That's a very Roy title.
Yes. And it sort of, you know, needed to be more professionalized than that. But from the start, a lot of stuff I did was trying to get people to be more actively involved and to think a little bit differently about things and expand their thinking, you know, and that continues with doing the podcast where I try and not just address sort of the day-to-day issues, but also bring in some little off-topic things that nonetheless shine light inside. Like I just did one, that aired last week with Bill Rubel, who's one of the producers of Ted Lasso, which I think if anyone hasn't watched it, you really should watch the series because it's a great demonstration of real leadership done the right way. And what's been interesting is, as I talked to him, is they actually studied leadership as they were doing the show. And then likewise for the conferences through the years, I've tried to figure out ways to make things a little bit more involving and finding unconventional approaches. I think one of the early shockers I did was bring in the host of the TV or the star of the TV show Pawn Stars, that takes place in the pawn shop in Vegas.
And, yeah.
I and everyone else learned there is just a tremendous amount of compliance that goes into running a pawn shop.
Interesting.
Including every transaction is uploaded to the police department every day. So because they want to make sure nothing's stolen. And it's just continued to do that involved. I've been involved a lot with our international programs through the years, which has been really fun. I never thought I'd be one of the people that would get the thick passport, but yeah. I did, because we're up to, I think, 17% of the membership of the SCCE at this point is located outside the United States.
Wow. And you've been there for that whole wave.
Yeah. I mean, when I started like a few weeks before we did our first international program, we did an academy in Zurich. And I fortunately got to go and see that. And then we sort of took a pause because 2008, as you know, the wheels came off the economy for a while. And then we started again and got very active in Brazil. One of our board members, Shin Kim, is a partner at a firm there. And these days, Brazil is the association's second biggest country by membership.
Wow.
So it's been interesting going there. I mean, they've got a terrific business community, but they got real compliance challenges, as everyone knows. And, you know, since then, we do programs in Dubai, Singapore, Europe, and continue to do them in Brazil. So it's been fun. Obviously, for the last year, there's not exactly been any international travel. but we're trying to serve everyone through virtual programs.
So over your time, you know, you've been there since 2008, you said?
Yeah.
So I'm sure that the organization, the industry has transformed so much. When you look at the role SCCE or the HCCA play in this game that we're in, what are you most proud of being a part of during that, you know, whatever, 13-year transition since you've been here and been able to put more of your fingerprints on this thing, you know?
I think what's been really great is that the association has evolved so much in terms of what we do for people. You know, it's everything from expanding internationally, recognizing the fact that there was really not much out there to help compliance professionals network and train in compliance outside this country. I mean, there were conferences typically run by for-profit conference companies that were fine, but that was about it.
Right.
You know, and I think that's been terrific. I think what's also been great is seeing compliance get more accepted dramatically within organizations and us helping to help compliance people as that happened to understand what kind of skills they need, how to work with a board, and also stay on top of all the things that have been changing. And then outside the United States, it's been interesting because back in 2008, compliance programs were really driven pretty much exclusively by the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the fear of, you know, a big massive settlement in that area. But over the years, it's really expanded dramatically to include the wealth of issues you would deal with domestically, but also things like economic sanctions are a big issue, or as privacy laws have expanded. That's gotten to be obviously just an enormous area of risk for organizations. And then I think one of the things really been nice over the last year is seeing us embrace virtual meetings.
I mean, yeah,
we didn't do any conferences virtually. We had web conferences, but you know, those were 1 hour, hour and a half things. To do so much this way has really done a couple of things. First, it's shown us that we can take meetings and do them that way and been able to continue to help people meet their educational needs. But secondly, it's shown an opportunity to do 1 and 2 day events that wouldn't have worked if you tried to get people to fly across the country for a 4 hour or an 8 hour, even a day and a half program. They don't do it.
Right.
You know, it's too much travel for too little learning. And now we've been very successful with programs on, you know, for example, putting together better training, how you do that more successfully. We just did one that worked very well on how to handle reporting. When a, you know, when an employee makes a report, what do you do about it? Not the investigation part. We actually have a separate program on that, but managing the whole process. And we're going to continue to keep adding these kinds of programs so that even if, you know, whenever it is, we're all back to sort of a normalish mode and people are traveling for meetings, we'll go back to doing things in person. In fact, we're already, as we're recording this, we're a week away basically from the start of the Compliance and Ethics Institute, which will be both virtual and in person. But as we do more and more in person again, we're still going to keep these virtual meetings that give people a chance to do a deep dive on a topic. And that's just a great opportunity.
When it comes to these topics and these programs that you guys come up with and that you roll out, where do your ideas come from?
A lot comes from different places. I mean, part of it is internally identifying the need of, you know, there's not really enough on this topic. Some of it is pushed by somebody who's zealous and makes a really good case for that. The board obviously will tell us, you know, that they think that we need more content in a given area. And a lot of it is watching things and seeing what's evolving and saying, like, right now, ESG is exploding out there. And so, you know, we put together a program on that and we'll continue to do. I mean, and one sort of begets another. You know, when we looked at, like, for example, we did programs on internal investigations that pivoted to an online version of it. Mm-hmm. We saw the need for something on training, and that's something that companies continue to struggle with after all these years, and did that. And now there's going to be more, you know, similar single topic. We're going to do one on how to manage compliance ambassadors programs.
Cool.
You know, we found out that there's actually a lot of them out there. And while at our meetings and elsewhere, there may be one session on a multi-day agenda, there's nothing that gives people a real, you know, in-depth look at that area. And so we've got a program scheduled for that. That's a virtual meeting coming up.
I think you guys do a good job of going from the theoretical to the tactical. You know, there's a lot of academic thought in this realm that we're in, which is great. Those are great guiding principles. But that last mile of actually, well, how do I implement that in my business, given the constraints I have, or given the geographic footprint we have or whatever, that's where I see a lot of stuff kind of die. It's almost like, you know, we go to these sessions and we put all the, you know, we mix all the ingredients, we put it in the cake pan, and then we're like, here's your cake. And it's like, well, you got to bake it. You know, we have, we, in order to cut a slice, it needs to be an actual cake that's baked, can't be a liquid anymore. And you guys do a good job of being that oven to let that whole, you know, idea sort of rise and be something that's more, I don't know, substantial or, you know, solid. Has that just been a natural progression of your organization? Has that always been a heart of your organization? How are you guys able to do that so well, whereas others, not just even in our industry, just in general, seem to sort of lag on that last lap?
Well, first of all, I got to say, when you refer to the oven reference, I can't, you know, not look at the fire going behind you. And
I got fire on the mind. I got heat on the brain. Yeah,
that's great. I actually wish I'd brought a virtual marshmallow and could make some s'mores right now. But I think it's a combination of two things. I want to take credit within the organization for the fact that we're not an academic institution. We're not a think tank. We don't spend our time staring at our navels and contemplating the universe. We know that our job is to help people do their jobs. And likewise, compliance people themselves want to know, okay, what do I do about this?
Yeah.
And we try and make sure that we keep the focus on that. You know, and while we've had academics speak, I think of somebody like Paul Fiorelli, who's an ethicist at Xavier University, you know, has spoken. He understands the theoretical principles of ethics, but knows the practical, like a, same with like a Marianne Jennings. And so that's what we want, because we know people need takeaways. You know, they don't come to the conference just for eating giant cookies and to hang out with each other. They're there to do those things, but also to have stuff that they can go back and do it. And I know personally from my own experience, it was, I got a good lesson from Gretchen Winter years ago, when she was still, I think, at Baxter. And I put together a session topic that nobody came to. This is when I was still at LRN at a conference. I got really bad attendance. And she said to me, oh, that was a really neat looking session. And I said, well, why didn't you come? She said, because given the choice between something that's interesting and something that's going to give me five things I can do now, I got to go to the session that gives me five things I can do now.
Interesting.
And we try and keep it that way as much as possible. Now, a general session, you know, the big keynote stuff, that can be
totally
provocative.
Yeah, yeah.
That can be about getting people talking and thinking differently. And you can have a few sessions like that. But at the end, if you don't have meetings where people walk out of them thinking, I have 50 things I can do as soon as I get back to the office, they're not going to come back, because they're not there to just study this in the abstract. And, you know, frankly, when people do, I mean, sometimes we've all seen these academic papers, sometimes they're like, what does that have to do with reality?
Yeah. At some level, there's like an exchange that happens at these sessions. And, you know, in the concept of like currency, there's like actual and like psychic currency. Like if you invest in a company that's an ESG company, part of your return is not just the dollars that you get. It's also the peace of mind of knowing that you've made a virtuous investment with those dollars. So let's call that kind of, you know, psychic currency. To the extent that it's a navel-gazing session, they're walking out with psychic currency. They're walking out with, oh, that's a cool idea that I can chew on and think about while I'm waiting for the plane to taxi. Whereas when they're walking out of a session, to your point of like, here are some actual things that I can put into practice, that's much closer to an actual currency that they can spend and get more leverage in their organization or more effectiveness. That's a pretty great, that Gretchen's advice I'm absorbing as we speak.
No, it's great. I mean, and it was really good and honest. And what I liked about it is it changed my ideas about what I would pitch when I was still on the vendor side meetings. And it's also affected me now that I'm here at the association and sit there and think, okay, that would be cool. But you know, those are the kinds of things that are really great for a general session to get people pumped and excited and then do it. But you know, you need people walking out the door excited that they get to go back to work and apply these things. And sometimes there's a bit of both. And I think one of the good things about our meetings is because, like on the SCCE side, we have so many different companies from so many different right. industries, you end up seeing things that you wouldn't think about. And it raises your horizons. You know, I think of years ago on the HCCA, I just joined the association. There was a need to have a session on training. And so Roy asked me to put one together, and I grabbed somebody in healthcare who had a good program and somebody from defense who had a good program for training. And the healthcare person did the presentation and the whole room loved it. You know, they were inspired. They thought this was great. And then the person from the defense industry showed what they were doing. And when she was done, the whole room, including the first presenter, were sitting there like this, you know, slack-jawed, because they had no idea that you could go to that level.
Wow.
And, you know, it's one of those things that I think you get from cross-industry meetings yes. and trying to bring in as many people is what's rocks for your industry or it's really cool may actually be the best in the world, or you may be 5 years behind the curve, but you're right. only benchmarking against each other.
And I think that's a lot of the magic of the SCCE, because you do, it's maybe the SCCE coupled with the industry that we're in. I think our industry leads or lends itself to more sort of cross-pollination potential. And I think those events do a great job of getting those same people in the room, so to speak, to let those ideas kind of bounce back and forth, because mm-hmm. it's always going to be sort of some sort of customized application of whatever concept we're talking about in the context of your sort of unique set of assets and constraints and difficulties and challenges and whatever. And talking to people who have gone through that, you know, kind of have gone up that mountain already can usually help accelerate you, you know, to the summit quicker, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's best to learn from somebody else who's either made it to the summit or fallen along the way than to have to go through it yourself.
Right. So I get the vibe from you that you've really kind of found your groove. Like it seems like you're in a position in an organization that where the purpose of the organization seems to resonate with who you are. It seems like it's a role that that allows you to put your unique gifts to work in sort of the most effective way. If that's accurate, what was that path? You know, again, you wound up in compliance by accident. At some level, you kind of wound up in SCCE by accident. Like, what was that path along the way? And when did you hit a tipping point where a light bulb turned on, where you're like, okay, this is the horse I should be riding?
That's a really good question. And I think, what's funny is now I think about it. When I look through my career, I've always chosen what I thought was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I obviously needed to make money, so I didn't pursue something that didn't pay, but I always wanted to do something that I had a passion for. And, you know, my first job out of college, I spent 2 years working for a senator on Capitol Hill. And then I ended up getting interested in advertising and spent 13 and a half years in ad agencies. And as I joke, I was the only person who went into advertising from a profession that was held in even lower esteem than advertising.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's interesting about it is your job there is to become passionate about the brands that you're working on. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was always exciting and interesting about it was learning what made things sell and what didn't, you know, whether that was I was working on the Burger King account or I was working on breath mints or bottled water. You know, you end up learning a lot about how people make decisions. And I got to say, the advertising skills ended up being very relevant for compliance. So much of compliance is about persuasion and getting people to do it. And I did, you know, other things a little bit along the way too, but I got into this, you know, when I was working at LRN, you know, there's something very rewarding about a job where you're trying to keep people out of trouble. And even though I'm not a lawyer, the legal stuff has always interested me, you know, and it's been, there's still a part of me that can't believe the guy who said he didn't go to law school, who didn't go to law school and didn't want to, ends up spending his time with, you know, so many in-house counsel and prosecutors and speaking at, you know, I had one fun conference that I got to speak on a panel with this very nice U.S. attorney who I ended up spending 3 days in St. Petersburg, Russia with, who was Loretta Lynch.
Wow.
You know, and when she became attorney general, I could say, wow, I spent 3 days in Russia with her before. But anyway, it was just, you know, it's been interesting. And what's nice is it's also been a profession where I've seen people grow. I've seen it grow. The issues change. And, you know, the reality of all the problems we see in the world that are sort of coming out of the corporate sector, you know, knowing what the problems are and why they're there and having a better sense of it has been, you know, nice. And I do sometimes find myself to be the explainer in chief when something happens as to, well, this is why these things happen, or sometimes telling people, you may want to think twice before you do that. So,
you just said that so much of compliance is persuasion. Let's double click on that. What do you mean by that? And why is that not just embedded in the, you know, the stone tablets of every chief compliance and ethics officer's mind?
I think, you know, I got to give a lot of credit to Dan Roach, who is one of the co-founders of SCCE. He has this great thing he'll do in a session where he says, raise your hand if you're in charge of compliance in your organization. And, you know, at a SCC or HCCA conference, most hands go up. And he said, you're wrong. Your business people are in charge of compliance. You're in charge of the compliance program. And the reality is, compliance people aren't the ones who are billing the government falsely or doing the privacy violation or paying the bribes. You're there to have a program to keep other people from doing those things. And when they do them, to provide effective remediation for them. And so day in and day out, the job of the compliance person is to persuade people to do what they're supposed to do, and also to have controls for when they don't do what they're supposed to do. And when they don't, it's, you're going to have the persuasive skills to get management to act appropriately. And then everyone, if remediation is needed beyond just this person is a bad egg, you know, they got to go, to say, look, we're structuring something wrong here and we're opening the door for this, to persuade the rest of the management team that we've got to do something differently here. And likewise, as you know from talking to compliance people, the worst thing you can be is Mr. No.
Yeah, right.
Or Ms. No. You know, you're basically there saying, can't do that, but let's find something we can do and help people move to that place where they feel as if they're made, where they not only feel, but they are making progress, but doing so in a way that doesn't create problems.
So as, you know, if you look back over your time in this ethics and compliance game, when has this persuasion thing been as big of a part of the sort of broad conversation as it is right now? Has this always been an undercurrent, or is it, do you feel like there's a swell of always, it now?
Yeah, no, I think it's always been there. I think it gets talked about more. I mean, in the early days when I started 20 years ago, when compliance was still very, not just lawyer driven, but in-house counsel driven, it was much more about, let's just cover what we need to cover.
Right.
And like, you know, you look at compliance training classes, then they were 40 minutes long. You know, the web-based stuff was 40 minutes long, a lot of deep content that probably in retrospect wasn't that necessary. Mm-hmm. Versus now where it's much more focused, to the point, quick stuff, repeated message. That shift took a long time to come, but it's moved step by step. I mean, again, when I started 20 years ago, everything was 40 minutes. By the time I left LRN, there were still the 40 minute courses, but there were short courses. And so was everybody else doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. They all had different ways they did it, but everybody started realizing more. Now we've got all kinds of short mechanisms, you know, for it. And so I think it's going to keep going that way because, you know, people realize increasingly, look, we're in the human behavior business. We're not in a legal business. We're in the human behavior business.
Yeah, I think the frame you just described is spot on, and I think it's actually a very powerful frame for somebody who doesn't have that positional authority, which most ethics and compliance people, you know, don't have, at least relative to other departments. That frame will allow you to really unleash and not waste efforts and not waste activities on unfruitful things. You know, mm-hmm. you can dial in, understand better what you can and can't control, and now you have a subset of all the levers available that you actually need to focus on, and those are ones of altering that human behavior. We have a framework that we talk about a lot, and it's this compliance 3.0 framework. So, you know, and it's a way to basically look at where a particular program or where the broader industry is over its life cycle. And so you kind of described the compliance 1.0 20 years ago when it was legal focused, defensibility focused, check the box. we've moved into this phase of, okay, compliance is a thing. It's sort of, you know, it's in its adolescence or something. It's a going concern department within most organizations. And hey, we need some tools to be more efficient. We have a bunch of things we have to get done. So we get dashboards and we get software and we get things that help us do our job better. The promised land that we all want to ascend toward is this compliance 3.0, where we're not a back office cost center. We're viewed as a strategic lever in our organization. We are, you know, at the table, so to speak, you know, at the boardroom table, so to speak. And we're really unleashed and actualized to release that magic that's in the workforce. So right now, I would say, I'm not trying to lead you by any means, but right now I would say that we as an industry are kind of largely in that compliance 2.0 phase. You have probably a long list of organizations and programs that are clearly living out that compliance 3.0, where they are the arbiters of culture and human behavior in the organization and helping to keep, you know, they're these trusted advisors in their organization and so forth. What do you think it's going to take for the overwhelming majority of programs that that we all deal with and come in contact with to be in that final chapter? Maybe it's come to Vegas. Maybe that's the answer. I don't know.
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, I think we'll get closer, but look, none of us like being told what to do. You know, nobody ever gets happy when the police pull them over.
Right.
You know, even if you get a warning, you still resent it. You know, you feel, whew, I didn't get a ticket, but you got a warning. Mm-hmm. And nobody likes buying insurance. You know, every month when I deduct from my checking account all the various insurances for life and home and auto and all of that stuff, it's like I don't enjoy it.
Right.
And I think that's going to be an issue. However, a lot of those things save people's butts eventually. And I think the organizations where compliance does that help a lot, you know, it helps them have status. I think some of the things we should do is like look at language a little bit and make things more positive. Like compliance teams talk about near misses. I would talk about saves.
Yeah.
You know, we had a save there. And trying to figure out ways that we can make what is perceived as a burden more of an asset, but recognize we're never going to be loved, because ultimately you may get that love at that moment where you stop something huge from happening and you identify, you know, a disaster and you can get to the government and say, look, this was starting. We stopped it. We did this, this, and this. We caught it before it got big. So the damage was this big instead mm-hmm. of you expected it to be that big. And people give a big sigh of relief and understand the value of it, but versus the hot, new shiny thing that the company wants to pursue, we're not going to be that. But I think there's room for hope. I mean, with the whole ESG movement, compliance is not ESG. And I think compliance has a good role interacting with it. But I think what's good about it is it's showing people the importance of values and that decisions should not be only, the public is saying, we don't want you making decisions based solely on dollars and cents. We want to feel good and trust you. And part of that, compliance is going to play an important role in.
So for people who say that compliance is ESG, why are they wrong?
My belief is compliance deals with some of the things like corporate values, you know, get into ESG stuff and certainly making sure you're responsible environmentally. But compliance is about the organization living up to the obligations that are before it. Mm-hmm. And value statements are internal rather than external goals. And most ESG things are. I don't think compliance, though, should be a part of it because ultimately compliance is a control function. And your job is to make sure people do what they say they're going to do. And if you're the one setting goals, you can't be the one who's also checking those goals. So think about it this way. An organization is going to say, as part of our commitment to ESG, we're going to reduce our carbon footprint by X percent. And we've even incented our management team to do that. Well, that's right and great, but that incentive is a risk area because wherever people have an incentive, they have an incentive to cheat. And so it's compliance's job to check to make sure things are going right there and to put in, help put in controls on that. If compliance owns that goal, compliance has a conflict of interest there.
Right. It's kind of like if finance owns internal audit or something.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. And so I think there needs to be, and I think, tremendous amounts of interaction between the two. I think both, like I said, are about the organization's values and how it lives up to them and making decisions of right and wrong. And a lot of that's lawful. I mean, there's a lot of stuff under ESG that, you know, stems from law and increasingly will. Mm-hmm. Because governments have made it clear that they're starting to now look at businesses in different ways and requiring things, whether it's more women and people from diverse backgrounds on the board of directors, whether it's investors really making an ESG fund that invests based on ESG, doesn't just market itself that way. And certainly in things like, you know, environmental issues, human trafficking and modern slavery, anti-corruption, there's lots of areas there where there is real law and ESG goals. But it's a job of compliance to make sure that the organization is truly living up to them and not just saying they are.
Right. I don't know. It seems like kind of an interesting time as this ESG thing has entered the discussion because nobody knows like what the shape of it's going to be. Nobody knows kind of how we're going to account for it or anything like that. And we don't know how it's going to actually sort of take root in our companies. What are your biggest concerns with this whole movement?
I think it's like anything where money chases money. There's the chance that people are going to be tempted to game this a lot, that they're going to see, as we've seen already with allegations, that investment funds saying that they're an ESG fund.
Don't seem
to be investing on that, or organizations saying that they've made X, Y, and Z commitment and don't quite live up to it. The hard part is it can produce a lot more cynicism, which is the last thing this world needs at this point. And if people are consistently being disappointed that instead of a real green commitment, there's greenwashing going on, then it's going to be difficult to sustain and could end up, you know, producing much more negative consequences for everyone as people have ever less faith in business. I mean, there already is a lot of cynicism and a lack of trust out there. And if companies start setting bars for themselves that can't be reached, it's just going to be really destructive.
Yeah. And to your point, it introduces this bizarre sort of, incentive, this perverse incentive, essentially, to greenwash. That potential is absolutely there because we're kind of mixing the soup and the nuts. We're mixing the dollars with the altruism, which again is harder to draw a circle around and prove and make objective. And, you know, those externalities are hard to denominate, whereas, you know, the dollars that come out of a business are very easy to count and put on a spreadsheet, you know?
Yeah. And people, by the way, don't give credit. I mean, you say you set a goal that you're going to reduce your carbon emissions by 15% and you make it to 10, which is a laudable goal, but you know, the headline is X company fails to meet carbon targets.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the bad part. And by the way, it's not just to blame it on the press. That's what we take away from it is, well, they didn't do what they said they would. Well, yeah, you're right. They didn't. But do we give people credit for their progress or not?
Yeah. So if we fast forward 5-10 years, how do you think ESG has, where is it at? How is it? How does it exist? Is it part of our normal nomenclature? Is there a chief ESG officer? Like how does this thing look, you know, 5-10 years from now, you think?
Gosh, if I knew that answer, I'd be cashing in big right now. I don't know. I mean, because, you know, part of me sits there thinks like, you know, I remember 15 years ago or whatever, going to a CSR conference, and then there was all the GRC conferences and everything else. And some stuff pans out, other stuff doesn't. I think this will continue to morph. You know, it's interesting, as much as a lot of this stuff is perceived as new, there's long roots in it.
Totally. I
mean, you know, ESG owes a lot to CSR. And even when you get to the idea of, you know, what business is doing the right thing. Nell Minow, I was doing a session with her, and she had a picture of sugar from the West Indies that it was a glass container of it that said, you know, harvested without slaves or slave free. And that was from like the 1700s. You know, these issues have gotcha. Been around and will continue to be for people. I think, like anything, it's going to get a lot of attention for the near term. And then, you know, in truth, if it's real and becomes a lasting movement, it'll get less sexy over time and get to be more what business does, you know, and then until, you know, there's another inflection point. I mean, the thing we all have to realize is business goes through year after year of setting higher expectations, generally on dollars, you know, how much in revenues, how much in profit, or how much X we're going to churn out and why. What's not recognized is that social expectations keep rising, you know, that what we expect yeah. people to do, what we consider to be right and wrong changes. You know, go back 100 years ago or more, I don't know what the right year is to go to, but child labor was perfectly fine. 12-hour days, 6 days a week was perfectly fine. You know, workplace safety, if you got injured at work, it was your fault.
Right.
You know, all these things change. And then you deal with, you know, more modern issues like, you know, LGBTQ rights, women's issues, all those things. The standards of behavior keep rising. And business is going to have to keep doing that and, you know, recognize that much more than it does. I mean, but a lot of the problem is business keeps operating on the floor, not realizing the floor is rising, and eventually yeah. you're going to trip. And I think we're going to continue to see expectations rise. Now, if we continue to call it ESG, maybe it may be something else. Mm-hmm. But I think regardless, business needs to realize that social expectations rise, you know, for businesses just as they, you know, rise in our own personal lives of what we consider acceptable or not.
So I find this sort of transition from CSR, corporate social responsibility, to ESG kind of interesting. What do you think is captured in ESG that wasn't captured in CSR? Like, why are we even talking about ESG when CSR was on the table? Were there blind spots to that? Was it a lack of execution that people got jaded by? Like, why is there a new thing that seems so much like the old thing?
You know, I remember going to the CSR conference and leaving with the impression that, as I said, trying to get a definition of CSR is like trying to hold Jell-O in your bare hands in a thunderstorm. It just keeps slipping through because everyone who spoke said CSR was their cause. So for some people, CSR was about business not paying bribes. For others, it was about environmental issues. For the next person, CSR was conflict minerals, whatever the issue was. And I always felt as if that moment, that movement, while it was definitely consistent on the idea that business should be responsible, there was tremendous fluidity in what that meant. ESG to me just started to emerge to have a much stronger, more coherent framework around it.
Okay.
In terms of what it's talking about. And I think what's interesting is as the investment community gets more involved and as there are accounting standards, and I'm blanking on what the acronym is for the standard body that people turn to for accounting.
For GAAP?
No, it's not GAAP. It's actually something that's ESG specific.
Oh, the ESG one. Sorry.
Yeah. That there gets to be more discipline about it. Mm-hmm. And I also think the time is more right, you know, for it.
Socially, globally, whatever.
Socially, everything else. I mean, we've seen a lot of changes in the world as people have woken up to issues and also businesses' willingness to take a stand on issues mm-hmm. that previously it shied away from. And I think that's a force that will give this longer legs than it might normally have had, and certainly more than CSR did.
Yeah, I've never held Jell-O in a thunderstorm, but I can imagine it's pretty hard. Yeah, I It'll be interesting to see how it develops and how these like ratings agencies that emerge, you know, which ones end up sticking around. Because, I mean, again, the big challenge is sort of comparability across industry. Who's more ESG, right? Who's more conscious or whatever? That'll be interesting to see. But, I mean, these dynamics exist in other industries for other things. Like, you can figure out a way to denote or quantify, you know, something that's qualitative or something, you know?
Right.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about your organization, because like last year was really tough for everybody. I imagine it was probably particularly hard for an organization that, while a nonprofit, is focused on, you know, staying afloat by having these activities and these, you know, events and so forth. You were one of the organizations really kind of across the board. I'm talking about not just in the compliance game, that I thought did a good job of pivoting and staying afloat and moving through those challenges of last year. I'd love to just hear about what last year was like and how you guys were able to pivot so well and why you were in such a good position to, you know, still be standing, you know, in 2021 and obviously, you know, presumably into the future.
Yeah. So it was not fun. You know, we had our healthcare annual meeting with like 3,000 people, supposed to be in April last year, March, and then the world stopped basically. And there was battles with hotels over cancellations and all of that stuff. As you know, we forget, now we look back. It's kind of funny. I was watching Modern Love on Amazon Prime, and you know, there's this scene of two people on a train back home for 2 weeks until this is over.
Yeah, right.
You know, and there was that feeling that, well, we'll flatten the curve and move on in a month or two, and then realizing, no, this is cascading and getting worse and worse. And I really got to give credit to our planning staff. Our meeting planners quickly figured out how we can do meetings online, because we hadn't done anything that way other than a web conference, let alone a multi-day, you know, 8 or 10 simultaneous tracks conferences. And what ended up happening was they figured it out in like 2 weeks how to make this happen.
Crazy.
And then we had to rearrange things with speakers and everything else. And, you know, and frankly, what's nice also is the compliance community rolled with it. You know, people still had needs. They still needed to learn. And certainly on the healthcare side, they had to figure out how to stay on top of what was a dramatically changing environment.
Right.
You know, all of us know from the sort of consumer side, you know, there were no elective surgeries. You know, you couldn't go into the hospital with a family member. But the government was changing rules to be very helpful. I mean, to do a lot of waivers so that things got easier really quickly, but you still have compliance issues to deal with, plus everything else that you'd always had. So there was a real need. There was no time to figure it out, but the planners did. And we quickly got up and running on that. And then realizing, okay, this is not going away. What do we do? And basically what we did, with one exception, is everything moved online. So our various conferences, we just knew were going to be online and virtual. We ended up adding, as I said, some more of these 1 day and 2 day things as ways to give people an opportunity to learn, address topics, and frankly, take advantage of this new opportunity. Our academies, which are, you know, 3.5 day, very intensive classes on how to manage a compliance program, did not really lend themselves to a virtual format. Because the room gets broken up multiple times in the course of a day for people to work through exercises together. But we established something that's more basic than them, a real newbie course, so that people who are brand new could still get some training in compliance, and did that online. But as soon as the world started allowing it, we started creeping back. So starting, I think, last June, we did our first academies socially distanced, and you know, like half the number of people in the same amount of space that we normally would. So everyone had their own table and speakers were behind a line taped on the floor and all of that stuff. We've continued to do those, and people are signing up for them now a lot. A lot of them have sold out already, which we know in the end of the year. Yeah. And I think really it was a realization. I mean, it's fortunate when you don't have any choice, you got to do something.
Yeah, right.
And so we didn't have a choice. I mean, you still couldn't fly to Nashville and sit in the conference room, you know, because nobody's coming there.
Right.
You know, and in some places it was kind of dramatic. I mean, we had one hotel internationally where we're supposed to do an academy. They closed. We couldn't still, I don't think, have reached anyone at that hotel.
Wow.
But, you know, that was it. It's done. So what do? You got to move on. And we realized we needed to do that both to educate the profession. And then you had all the people who are certified who have to keep their training hours up. So we needed to find ways for them to get it affordably and with live programs, and really sort of took advantage in a good way of this opportunity to say, okay, how much of our existing stuff can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And let's get it going. And then what else can we provide people? And it's worked out nicely. And, you know, now we'll enter the next phase. I mean, you know, like I said, as I record this, we're a week away from our first hybrid meeting, where we're going to have a few hundred people in Las Vegas for the Compliance and Ethics Institute and many more hundred people online watching it.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to see how that works.
How do you feel about the Vegas thing? It's going to be kind of interesting, huh?
I'm excited to be around people again that I'm not related to.
Yeah, get a little of that normalcy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking to a guy who, before this happened, as I said, I went from traveling 130 days a year to checking the fridge 130 times a day.
Jeez Louise.
And
you don't get any passport stamps for checking that fridge again, you know?
No, you don't. I mean, you know, the good part is I'm a bicyclist. I got so many miles in that I actually cracked the frame of my bike.
Wow.
Which is not good because you can't find bikes.
That's a big accomplishment for a cyclist.
Yeah, no. I mean, I rode 7,000 miles, I think I figured.
Oh, my gosh.
Since this began, which is great. But I'm very excited to be around people. And one of the things we hear from people is they want to be around each other. I mean,
totally.
We've tried networking stuff online. It's not the same. When we talk to other associations, they all say the same thing is it's not the same. It just doesn't work. You know, and there's something that you lose from the fact that a session ends and you turn to the person next to you and say, that was great. Or am I crazy? Or is this weird? You know, those kinds of things, which become the basis of relationships, are gone. You know, and now with the ability to return to live meetings, you know, hopefully, and more of them over the coming months, we should be able to see that coming back, because that's sorely needed. I mean, this is a job where, compliance is a job where you need to hear what other people are doing.
Yeah,
and
right.
You need to have people you can trust, and an ever widening network helps, because again, you may know some compliance people in your town, you may know a few in your industry, but they don't have the answer to every question. And the more people you can turn to, the better off you are. And live meetings gives that opportunity to do that. Any really giant cookies again. So
there you go. Yeah. And you can grab a couple, if you're slick and you get the bag, you can grab a couple extra for late night.
We pay by the cookie. So we discourage.
You discourage it. I'm giving people life hacks who show up at the
meeting.
I'm kidding.
Do that. And you have no idea how much a can of soda costs at these meetings. So please don't.
Oh, is it crazy?
Bags for later.
It's $3 a can. Yeah,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah,
and they got to, you know, these hotels got to make up for last year, so it might be $4 a can. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? I thankfully don't see that bill and don't want to.
You know, you guys, you know, as you were talking about 2020 just now, it was very clear that you are part of a very tenacious organization, and I think the average sort of ethics and compliance and HR person is very tenacious because they're usually up against it. Where do you think that tenacity comes from? With respect to your team and the people that you work with every day?
I think for all of us, you know, part of it is knowing the members well, you know, and it's not an abstraction of who we're helping.
Right.
You know, especially for the planning team, you know, they're on the phone constantly with speakers and volunteers, you know, who are helping select sessions, and they go to the meetings and they hear the conversations. And for, you know, others of us too are similar positions. I mean, we knew we had to do this, and we know the world was changing, you know,
right.
You know, you deal with, again, like I said, the healthcare side of things, you still have all the existing rules. Some were eased because of it, like, you know, telemedicine just basically was theoretical before this
totally.
Happened. It was not done. And now it's everywhere, and the government made it possible. But they still had to make sure they were following rules. You still had to deal with privacy issues outside of it. you know, you see the struggles of companies where, you know, their supply chain's in tatters because of this. They need, whether it's the PPE, they need the equipment, or there's, you know, the manufacturer of X can't get stuff out of their country because they're in a shutdown, but yep. this other manufacturer can. You can't do the third party vetting that you normally would want to, but right. you got to do something. So clearly organizations are struggling with that, and then dealing with the issue of they're not in the office either. You know, right. they're not passing people in the hall. So you knew you couldn't walk away and just say, see you when it's over.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. Well, I'll see you in a couple weeks, 2 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it quite clearly wasn't going to be 2 weeks after those first 2 weeks, and things just kept getting worse. And we just had to realize, okay, let's move things over as quickly as we could. You know, dealing with realities is sometime a hotel would say, no. And, you know, you have to wait till the hotel didn't have any choice because,
right.
you know, especially that first era, not every state was closing right away. And then eventually they all, you know, pretty much did. And it was clear you couldn't do meetings, and they've been good. I mean, there's a lot of people are going to ask, like, why are you back at this? You know, I thought you were going to do that hotel last year. It's like, yes, we just moved the contract, you know, the contract to this year or the next year. So
I think tenacity is this really interesting thing, because if I ask kind of tenacity questions of people, people who are tenacious, they always describe it as like, well, what else was there to do? I had to do something. And people who kind of lack tenacity are usually like, you know, there's nothing I could have done. Well, it's like, well, how right. did you take the hill? Well, we hit the beach and we burned the boat, so we had to take the hill. You know, how are right. you so tenacious in taking the hill? So I think that's an interesting kind of a frame, because, you know, I don't know. It's like the number one key to, I mean, maybe I'm just talking about grit. You know, it's like the number one key. Maybe it's grit and intelligence are like the number one predictors of like success. But, you know, I just think that that willingness to pivot is so strong. The willingness to see what's, you know, this wall that's in front of us and say, I can't keep beating my head against it. We have to do something else. That's also strong. And that's a fluidity that a lot of organizations, you know, lose as they grow, because, hey, this is the way that we've done it. How do you think mm-hmm. you've been able to maintain your nimbleness as you guys have grown, and now 20% of your, you know, members are international and all that kind of stuff? How have you kept that core?
I think a lot of it has to do, before we get into that, I want to just add one thing to tenacity. I think also you have to always, being tenacious is good, but you also need to know what battles to fight and what not to.
Right. What hills are worth dying on? Yeah.
Right. What is where, and I think compliance people who are successful know that you can't fight everything.
Good
you
point.
Know, some stuff you do have to say no, other stuff you have to sort of guide into, you know, another direction. But in terms of for us as an organization, I think what's happened is we've never been that stagnant. I mean, we've always been adding meetings. It's not like, you know, yes, we had a regular schedule of things, but, you know, I give the example of the fact, you know, when it came to our international academies, we did that one in Zurich. It was okay. It didn't do so great. And then the economy took a downturn and we started looking again, and Brazil came up as a good opportunity and it worked. Mm-hmm. And then we tried, I think we went back to Europe after that. We moved around to Asia for a few years until we found a good home in Singapore to do them every year. Dubai's worked out nicely. You know, it's just finding what's the next thing. There's always been a sort of relentlessness to our pursuit of what else needs to be done. There's also been times where we've seen things that didn't work and we've pulled away from them or tried to do things differently. And then I got to say, in this era, a lack of choice helped.
Totally.
You know, when you can't just rely on what you've done and you got a choice of either evolve or die, there's really not much of a choice there. And so we did. And what I'm glad that we did is not only, as I said, shift existing stuff online, but say, hey, how do we take advantage of this and do more things?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, it's worked out. Some meetings have drawn okay. Others have been like crazy successful.
Well, you said something before that I didn't highlight, but just as you were talking about the 2020 thing, you said 3 or 4 times, opportunity, like what an opportunity mm-hmm. this is. And that's just a different frame. And that's just a different mentality around this challenge that came, and look at what that sort of frame or that lens you know, resulted in. It resulted in a broader reach, and it resulted in more options to get the information out to the folks who can actually put those things into practice. So, you know, as you were answering the question about agility, it sounded a little bit like the answer to tenacity. And I was just like, well, that was kind of a stupid question. Because if you ask, you know, somebody, you know, a 75-year-old woman who's still a gymnast, how did you stay so flexible? Well, she's like, well, I stretch every day. I'm just a flexible person. You know what I'm saying? I'm just a tenacious person. I would love to get, I have two more questions. I want to be conscious of time here. One is tactical and one is some navel gazing, just to wrap this all up. But the tactical question is, what advice would you give? So let me frame it. There are people who are interested in, you know, coming and being a speaker at a conference or whatever. And I've just heard, you know, people get frustrated when they're like, they work so hard on this proposal and they send it in and it doesn't get, you know, it doesn't get accepted. What do you think in general, as you guys are reviewing these things, like what are three tips or a couple of tips for someone who wants to do that, to make sure that like they hit the mark, they don't pitch something that's going to be like, you know, they're going to pitch something that has a higher propensity to like get accepted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So first I'll say, if you go to the call for speakers page on the SCC and HCCA websites, unless somebody's changed it, there should be two things I've written. One is just a whole bunch of tips for getting selected. And the other one is actually, I think, called How to Give a Bad Presentation at Our Conferences, which is tips for people who've been selected on what to do right and wrong. You know, and it's things like, don't begin a presentation by explaining what the federal sentencing guidelines are. I mean, you're in a room of compliance people. Right. They know that. Or why compliance is important. They know that. That's why we're here. But in terms of getting proposals accepted, there's several things I recommend. One is make sure you're saying something different.
Okay.
So a lot of times there's an area, like I give Foreign Corrupt Practices Act has been a big issue forever. Mm-hmm. We get probably, you know, let's say 12 proposals on that. And at least four of them are understanding the fundamentals of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Well, that was fine 15 years ago.
Totally.
At this point, everybody gets that. And so if you're in a crowded area that you know is a hot topic, but that everyone's going to do, figure out something new to say about it. And secondly, make it really clear in your title and description what it is people are going to learn from this session. I mean, we see a lot of proposals where I still don't know, you know, and all we ask for is title and three bullet points, which isn't a lot, which means it's not a lot to do and it's not a lot for people to judge off of, I realize, but you can't figure out what they're talking about.
Right.
Or why this is anything different. And I want to point out, by the way, the staff doesn't really pick the sessions. For most of our meetings, we have people who are volunteers who go through the proposals. You know, Jerry, Zach, our CEO, and I, and some stuff will have our hand in things. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's other compliance people looking at it. And they think like, no, I've heard this before,
right,
or this is interesting, or I don't know. A lot of times it's, I don't know what it's talking about. A lot of times also we get a lot of stuff that's ridiculously off base.
Like what?
And I don't understand why. I mean, in one case, like our European conference, we'll get a lot of stuff that's like, you got to be kidding. This is a conference for Europeans and it's about like state law in one state in the United States. And I think it's because people say, well, I'll send it in, maybe I'll get a trip to Europe, but if they pick it. But even domestically, you know, people will often put in stuff that's very, very narrow, like, you know, understanding compliance issues of terminations within the oil and gas industry.
I mean, it's like, okay.
You know, you take a pie this big and you've cut it down to a sliver.
Right.
And we don't have room on the agenda for that. So make sure also that it's relevant for a decent sized audience. It doesn't have to be for everyone, but it's got to be a lot of people. It's got to have lessons there. It's got to be different from what we usually have. Don't submit anything with a raft of speakers. You know, we'll get stuff where people want to put five people on. And we're like, at this point, I think we limit it to three anyway.
Yeah, it looks like a variety show.
Yeah. If you're a vendor, I think it's always good if you have somebody in-house that you're speaking with together. because people are a little suspicious that it's going to be a pitch. It's very, very, very rare that happens. In the 13 years I've been at the association, I have only once fielded a complaint that a vendor got up and pitched themselves. And I'm not joking. I mean, over dozens, if not hundreds of meetings, only once has that come up. But
what session is that vendor doing it in Vegas? I'm kidding.
They're not. But what's, and by the way, to the credit of the organization, the company the person worked for, when they saw what the reviews were, which were scathing, you know, they were, that person never spoke again. We've had other people from there speak, but not that person.
Got it.
But in truth, what I actually think personally, I like personally sessions where there's a vendor and somebody in-house, because a vendor can say what works across 100 companies.
Yeah.
And the in-house person knows what works there. And I think there's a good balance there. And I don't think people often appreciate the fact that you as a vendor have seen what works across lots of organizations. And that really counts. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else, quick tip. But no, it's just try and make sure you're saying something different, something that people can do something with. Make your description very clear and not too cutesy. Sometimes a little cutesy helps because it makes things,
there's some novelty in it.
Stand out.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I mean, there's a session at the CEI that talks about, does compliance validate, you know, as in parking. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a good, you read the description, it's a good thing and it ties in. And really try and think through, what do your peers want to hear? Not just what do you think is fun to talk about?
That last piece might be, I mean, it's all good advice, but that last piece is a big one, because it's based on an other's focus. We're focusing on what the audience, what does the audience need to hear, not what do I selfishly want. All right, so last question. If you could go back in time to a young Adam, what advice that now you've, you know, digested and you own, do you wish you had gotten earlier?
Well, use Rogaine for one thing. I don't know. I'm a person, for a guy who spends a lot of time talking in front of people who seems very comfortable, I'm racked with constant self-doubts and can remember everything bad I've done to anyone.
Oh, you too?
Or myself. Oh, yeah. Since like third grade. Thankfully, I can't remember much earlier than that. Honestly, I think I would say be more mindful of the impression I make on others, and realize that people don't always understand what you're thinking, and don't expect them to. And be well aware of those kinds of things. And, you know, my personal issue is I'm very glib. And as you know, I'm quick to say something to get a laugh, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I still have to be mindful of that. So
even to this day.
Even to this day.
All right. So then this is actually even better. This is even some advice for your future self, because once you listen to the recording.
Yes.
You can digest that then.
Yes, I will no doubt be listening and cringing later. So. In fact, I may build a fort around my desk and sit under it to listen.
Yeah, drape a blanket over the desk too, so you feel really, really safe
totally.
When you listen. This has been a lot of fun. Where can people find you? Where can they hear your podcast? Where can they learn more about you and get in touch?
All right. So I am on LinkedIn if you want to connect with me there. And the important thing is to spell my name properly, because we don't spell Turteltaub properly. It's TURTELTAUB, not TLE. And there are two Adam Turteltaubs, so make sure you pick the one who doesn't have enough hair when you go on LinkedIn.
Pick the glib one.
Yes, the glib one without the hair. And then you can also find me on the website. My email address is adam.turteltaub@corporatecompliance.org. If you're interested in the podcast, go to our blog, which is Compliance and Ethics, and it's spelled A-N-D, not the ampersand. So complianceandethics.org. And of course, for the associations, SCCE is corporatecompliance.org, and HCCA is hcca-info.org.
Well, Adam, I love your work. I love your organization and the role you guys play in the special community that we're all a part of. I love your comics. Let's get some more of those going, please. Appreciate you.
Got one today.
You do? Okay, good. Appreciate you coming on, and until next time.
Thank you. Take care.